This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hi, this is Gary Clinton. Welcome back to the Night Transmissions. Our first segment is going to be from the NBC show Dark Fantasy. Dark Fantasy aired on Friday nights for parts of 1941 and 1942, originating from Oklahoma City. It was a short-lived series that produced only 31 episodes on a shoestring of a budget that the show was able to rise above through the effective establishment of a spare atmosphere. It was an excellent show, however, that was in some ways well ahead of its time. Tonight's segment is an old story. There's a wronged husband, an unfaithful wife, a cad of a neighbor, and a murder. And, oh yes, a promise to come back from the grave. This is all in The Man Who Came Back, which first aired on August the 21st of 1948.
Dark Fantasy. I am the man who came back.
Break it up.
This way, officer. He's in here.
All right, miss. Casey.
Yes, Captain.
Now, you stay right there in that doorway and don't let nobody in or out.
Right, Captain. All right now. All right, you heard him.
Oh, but we had nothing to do with this.
Okay, sister. If you didn't, you ain't got nothing to be scared of. Hey, you. Where do you think you're going?
I thought I might get a little air, if you don't mind.
Well, I do mind. Now, back in the house with you. What's the big idea, you wearing that mask?
As you might have observed, my friend, this is a masquerade party.
Oh, is it now? Well, according to Emily Post, it's masks off at midnight. And we got this call to come out here just as the clock in Washington Circle was striking the hour.
The call was placed by a most hysterical woman. And there is nothing you can do for the man in there, I assure you.
Stop changing the subject. What I want to know is, why ain't you unmasked, like the others?
I prefer, sir, to wear my mask.
Take it off, Don Juan. I want to look at your mug.
It might be better, my friend, if you didn't see my mug.
Now look here, Zorro.
Perhaps while we are waiting, I might tell you a story.
Yeah? What is this? Bedtime at Grandma's? The only story I'm interested in is what happened here tonight.
Exactly.
Eh?
I said exactly. Perhaps I can tell you the story.
All right, then, my fine, mysterious friend. Give.
Well, you see, it's quite a long story. It really all began 3 years ago. I remember that evening quite well. I let myself into Granger's apartment. It was a golden key I used. A bright golden key. And there was no one there when I arrived. So I closed the door and waited. Well, Grange, imagine seeing me here.
Huh? Blake, oh, I say, you startled me.
Did I now? I dare say, had I been someone else, you wouldn't have been at all startled.
Incidentally, old man, how did you get in here?
I suppose it would be quite facetious of me to say that I came in the same way you did. Oh, I say, a new piano. Do you mind?
No, not at all. Go right ahead. Help yourself. Have a drink?
No, thanks. You'd better have one, though.
Hmm? Oh, well, yes. I say, Blake, what's that you're playing?
You've heard it before, Grange.
Have I? I don't recall.
You have a short memory.
I usually remember pretty well.
Well, when you choose to, you do, yes.
What do you mean by that?
My wife has played that tune for you every night this week and last and the week before that. You see, I happen to know.
Oh. I see.
Well, I'm glad you haven't the audacity to deny it.
No. No, I don't deny it. Your wife has been here. Often. As often as she possibly could. But I assure you, she came of her own desire.
And as a result of your oily persuasion.
I might agree, Blake, that she is easily persuaded. And of course, my curiosity prompts me to ask how you finally learned the truth.
I accidentally found the key to your apartment here. It was in Sylvia's purse. A golden key. With your initials engraved on one side, hers on the other.
Why, I thought that a rather handsome touch. Don't you agree?
I've brought the key back to you.
How gallant of you, old fellow.
I'm serious. Sylvia will never come here again.
Are you positive of that?
Quite. For I shall ask her not to.
You seem to believe she'll obey you.
She will. And I ask you now, Grange, as a gentleman, kindly refrain from inviting her here again.
In other words, hands off. Is that it?
I'm glad I make myself quite plain.
Why, you fool. You dull, stupid fool. What right have you to demand anything of Sylvia? Do you think for a moment, night after night, twiddling her thumbs while you're away from home?
I admit I've been busy this past year, but another 6 months...
You've no one to blame for Sylvia's being here but yourself. Here she's found what you denied her, Blake. And I doubt very much if she'll give it up.
Why, you swine, if you think for a moment... I forgot you carried a gun. But if you'd care to put it away...
Skip the heroics, Blake. You know, I think I've suddenly thought of a solution to all this.
The only solution is for you to leave Sylvia alone.
Oh, no. No, you're quite mistaken. This is the solution. Here in my hand. Indeed, I rather like the idea. Besides, with you out of the way, Sylvia need have no more qualms.
Why, you low yellow rat.
That's it, Blake. Come closer. Threaten me. Make me do it. Make me do it, Blake.
You think killing me is a way out, Grange? You're very badly mistaken.
It's the only way out.
If you kill me, Grange, I'll come back and avenge myself.
One shot and that'd be all. I can prove self-defense. Sylvia'll help. She'll swear you came here and tried to kill me.
I'll come back, Grange.
Just one shot directly between the eyes.
I'll haunt you, Grange, because by God in heaven, I'll come back.
It's a perfect scheme, yes, I like
I'll
it.
I'll pierce the veil, Grange, because I'll come back if I have to fight all the demons of hell to do it.
Prepare, Blake. This is a chance of a lifetime. It's the way out. Yes, it's the way out.
Grange!
Read all about it. Here you are, Mr. Keith Grange, playing self-defense and slaying a fellow Blake. Here it is, folks. Get your extra paper. Read the headline news about the killing. It's all here.
It is the judgment of this court that the defendant, Keith Grange, did shoot and kill the deceased, Philip Blake, on the night of April 16th, and that in so doing, he acted in the line of self-defense. The court therefore decrees that Keith Grange shall not be held to account for this unfortunate incident.
Thank you.
idea?
I suppose there's nothing to worry about now.
Not the slightest thing. I told you from the very beginning, Sylvia, that I acted rightly in doing what I did.
Oh, I still can't resign myself to it.
But you must. It's all over. Philip is dead. Now we can be together as much as we please.
Keith, suppose you and I should have a misunderstanding. Suppose I should become angry sometime. So angry, I might tell the truth to the authorities.
That, my dear, would be most unfortunate. But it's a possibility, and by no means should we overlook possibilities. So allow me to remind you, Sylvia, my dear girl, that your hiding the true facts of the matter of the coroner's investigation automatically makes you an accomplice.
Oh, I see. But why are we talking like this, darling? We'll both feel better after we've had a little rest.
Of course we will, dear.
Kiss me goodnight, darling. I'm going home.
I'll take you.
Oh, no. No, I'd rather go alone tonight, if you don't mind.
As you wish, my dear. Good night.
Good night, darling.
Sweet.
Will you call me in the morning?
Yes, of course I will.
Good night, then.
Good night, darling. Pleasant dreams. That's strange. Very strange. Just a moment ago, there were only Sylvia and I here. Now she's gone. Yet I feel that I'm not alone.
You're not alone, Grange.
What? What was that? I thought I heard a voice.
It was my voice.
Who are you? Where are you?
I told you I'd come back.
No. No, it's just my imagination.
Is it your imagination, Grange?
Yes. Yes, of course.
I warned you. I warned you. Remember?
Come out. Come out in the open. Come out, I say. Do you hear me? Come out.
Your gun is useless against me now, Grange.
What do you want? Tell me, what do you want?
Oh, not now. The time isn't right now. But I'll be back. For me and wait. Watch and wait, for I'll come back, Grange. I'll back.
No. No, I'm sure of it. It was no one. No one at all. I just imagined it, that's all. Yes, just my imagination. So tired. Here, perhaps this will wake you up. Present for you.
A present?
Yes. Something I picked up today. I thought you'd like it.
How sweet of you, darling. I think I can guess just by looking at the box. It's a ring.
Oh, aren't you clever? Go ahead, open it.
All right, darling, but don't hurry me. Oh.
Sylvia, that isn't the ring I bought for you.
Keith. Look at this ring.
The initials. P. B.
Keith. This is his ring.
Sylvia, what are you saying?
It's his ring. I gave it to him.
But Sylvia.
Keith, I swear to you. Philip Blake was buried with that ring on his finger.
Do you mind coming around to the other side, please, mister? That door's busted, and you can't get it open.
Oh, very well.
Sorry to ask that of you, but they ain't had time to get the other door fixed.
Where to, friend?
Huntington Arms Hotel, please.
Right.
Excellent.
Huh?
That's where I'm going.
Oh. Well, you startled me. I didn't know there was anyone in this cab. It's so dark tonight.
Yes, isn't it?
I say, I don't seem to feel anyone in the seat here beside me.
Strange. You certainly bumped me hard enough when you crawled in here.
bumped you? I beg your pardon, sir, but I...
Never mind, Grange. Never mind.
You know me?
I'm surprised that you don't know me.
Why, yes. Your voice sounds familiar. Good Lord. Philip Blake.
Do you mind riding with me?
Blake, you're supposed to be dead. You're supposed to be buried.
I am dead, Grange. I am buried.
Tabby! Tabby, stop this cab!
Right, sir.
Now, let me out of here. Let me out.
What's the matter, Governor? Hey, you hadn't ought to jump out of a moving car like that.
What in the name of heaven is in the back of that cab?
Why, nothing, Governor. Here, see? I'll turn on the light. There. See?
But there was somebody in there with me.
Oh, now, mister, there couldn't have been. Look for yourself. The seat's empty there. And you just jumped out on this side of the cab. The other door won't open. Nah, brother, there wasn't nobody in that seat with you. Must have been your imagination.
Hello? Hello, Doris? Dear, this is Sylvia. I just wanted to remind you about the masquerade ball at Keith's new home tonight. You'll be there? Fine. Now remember, masks and costumes for everybody. All right, dear. Bye. Now be sure to come in costume, won't you, Dorothy? Yes. And heavily masked, my dear. Yes, at Keith's new place. Oh, darling, wait till you see the place. It's really a mansion. Honestly, it's huge. I believe.
Sylvia, darling. So you've penetrated my disguise.
Silly. I heard you order it from the costumers yesterday. Darling, the music will start soon. Is the first dance ours?
Sylvia, my dear, every dance is ours tonight. Are you happy I bought this place?
Oh, it's lovely. Absolutely lovely, Keith. Darling, what's the matter?
That man in black. I've been watching him all evening. He's been watching me.
Do you know who he is?
No. He just stands and stares at me. Everywhere I go, he's always just a short distance away.
Look, Keith. He's going into your study.
Well, he hasn't any business in there.
Strange. I locked that door this evening so the guests wouldn't go into your study and disturb things.
Well, he just walked right in. And dear, I'll go see who he is and what he wants. You mingle with the guests and I'll join you later.
Very well, dear. But don't be long. I'll be waiting for you.
All right, sir. Yeah, it's odd. This door is locked. Dark. The piano. Oh, confound it, where's the light switch? There. No. No, it can't be. That piano. Someone's playing, and yet there's no one seated there. The keys, moving, up and down, playing the music, but there are no hands on them. That melody, it's the melody he played the night I killed him. He's playing it now, and yet he's not there.
I'm here, Grange. I'm here.
Blake.
Look closer, Grange. Here I am. You see?
Yes. I see you now.
I brought you a little gift to your masquerade party.
What?
You'll find it lying on your desk. Turn around and see for yourself. That's right. There. You see?
Gun.
It's the one you killed me with. Don't you recognize it?
Where did you get that gun?
I found it, Grange, and I've brought it back to you. I put one shell in its chamber. Just one, Grange. But that is enough.
What are you trying to... Gone. He's gone. Lord, am I mad? Was I dreaming? No. No, the gun is here. It is my gun. One cartridge, he said. Only one. One cartridge. Yes. Yes, it's the only way left. He knew it was the only way. Now he's left me to take it. All right, Blake. You can have your revenge. You can have it. You are right. It is the only way.
So he shot himself, eh?
The evidence in there will indicate that he did, yes.
Say, that's quite a yarn you spun, Zorro.
It is nothing but the truth.
Come on now, come on, my friend. Let's take off your mask and have a look at you.
One moment. Keith Grange shot Philip Blake squarely between the eyes.
Yeah? So what?
That doesn't make a very pretty st-
Well, I don't see what that's got to do with... here comes the captain. Here, take that mask off you. Captain Sullivan, come here a minute, will you?
Yes, Casey, what is it?
Well, there's a mug here who won't take off his mask. He's been spinning me the most fantastic yarn ever heard in all my... where'd he go?
Huh? Where'd who go? Say, did you let somebody get out of this house, Casey?
No, Sir Cap. No, I didn't. But he was standing here just a minute ago. He wouldn't take off his mask. He told me the darndest story about a murdered man coming back from the grave.
Casey, you been near the punch bowl? Well, there's no one here now. Wait a minute. What's this stain here on the floor?
Blood. A little pool of it. There on the floor. Right in the exact spot where the man in black was standing.
Man Who Came Back, an original tale of dark fantasy by Scott Bishop. Ben Morris was Keith Grange. Eleanor Naylor Corrin was Herda Sylvia. Fred Wayne took the part of Casey. Muir Height was Captain Sullivan. Murillo Schofield, the cab driver. And Eugene Francis was the man who came back.
Next, from the Canadian Broadcasting Company series Nightfall, we have an episode called Love and the Lonely One, which was also the premier show for its series. It hit the airwaves on July the 4th of 1980, and it's a story about two young men named George and Fred, a cadaver in a sorority house. As you can imagine, this brings together all of the ingredients for a title horror story, or a teen comedy from Troma Pictures.
In the dream, you are falling, lost in the listening distance as dark locks in. Nightfall. Love and the Lonely One.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Anatomy 4. I realize this is the first time most of you will cut into a cadaver, but take it from me, you'll get used to it. I well remember my first such model patient. I christened him Henry. Now, when you all become doctors a few years from now, you'll find some of your patients very temperamental. They're not my Henry. The more I cut him, the wider he grinned.
You realize that...
What?
We're committing a felony.
What?
George, if they find out we stole this thing, they'll kick us out of school so fast.
Kick us out of med school? Come on, Freddy. Hang loose. It's only a stiff. They'll blame it on the engineers.
You think?
Oh, sure. Hey, careful. We're almost there, Tiger.
Sorry.
Quiet. We got the whole damn sorority.
I can't walk backwards.
We'll turn around. God, look at her. Here, let me take the feet. Oh, look at her mouth. Reminds me what tomorrow morning's going to taste like.
George, are you sure we want to do this?
What the hell? The broad stood you up, didn't she? So what's the problem? We're dropping off a Valentine.
Valentine? The corpse of a dried-up old lady?
But you're forgetting my pink ribbons. And look, I remembered a card.
A card?
Yeah. You're the guy who reads poetry, aren't you? I even looked it up. Here, read it.
Dear Sally, the grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do their embrace. I'm beginning to think this is sick.
Sick? I'll tell you what sick is. It's listening to you moan every time anybody brings up that hose bag's name.
You know Sally's not like that, really.
Yeah, she's a real pain in the ass. How many times she stand you up this week?
Well, I don't know.
Come on, Freddy, where's your pride? You want to sit around feeling sorry for yourself and you want to get even with her. Now, come on, Freddy, enjoy your revenge.
Well...
Come on! Grab the arms. Let's get this stiff up these stairs before somebody comes. Okay, that's it. One more step. Now, just over here against the door. Now prop the old bag up so she just sort of drops in on the old door. Perfect.
Yeah, great. Now let's get the hell out of here.
Hey, I can just see those sorority airheads screaming their heads off. Okay, this is it. Now, when I hit that doorbell, we get out of here and fast. You ready, Freddy? Hey, Freddy, you with me?
Huh? What'd you say?
Are you ready?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, what are you staring at the corpse for? Fred, are you with me, for Christ's sake? They'll be here in a second. Let's move it.
Huh? Oh, yeah.
Get here behind. Jeez, buddy, you had me scared.
Sorry,
they'd seen us. What were you staring at? You in space or something?
I don't know. I saw her. In the light. Her mouth was green. And she was smiling at me.
Hey, George.
I hear Dr. Robb really lit into you on the wards this morning.
Yeah, so? He gets your ass in a sling every now and then.
Sometimes I wonder why we're doing this.
Huh?
Neuroanatomy midterm in 2 weeks.
It's a bitch, all right. Anyhow, I'm going skiing if it kills me. And if you knew what was good for you, you'd come too.
No way. I can't spare the time.
You can. Look out.
Wow.
Cardiac arrest team.
They'll get us next time.
Bunch of cowboys.
But they save lives.
Don't count on it. See you back at the ranch, huh, Patty?
Yeah. See you later.
You? Come here.
Doctor?
Get in here.
Oh, I'm just on wards, ma'am. I really don't think
that... You've got two hands, haven't you? Grab those electrodes. Nurse, a syringe. Thank you. Hold the electrodes on his chest.
This got it?
Right. Stand back. Hit the switch.
He moved.
King Tut would move if you ran that charge through him. How's the scan? Looks like he's had it. Try it once more. Stand back. Hit the switch. Nothing. That's it. Wrap it up.
Just leave him here?
Up to the orderlies now.
You're not going to try it again?
Again? He had a hole in his heart you could drive a truck through. He was living on borrowed time. Look at him. What color is his face?
He's purple.
Dark purple. Lack of oxygen. Even if we did get his heart going, the brain damage would be massive at this point. Excuse me. There's a 4-year-old in emergency. Nurse, get me the fire, please.
So fast. As though nothing happened. Phew. Nurse? Nurse? Nurse! Oh, well. Hello, 2 South.
Hello, Fred.
Who's this?
A distant admirer.
Who? What do you want?
Sure took a lot of nerve to pull off a stunt like that. Last night?
What stunt?
Oh, you wicked, wicked man.
I don't know what you're talking about.
But I like wicked men. I scare a lot of men, but... I bet I wouldn't scare you, eh, sport?
Are you a friend of Sally's?
Sally? Why don't you throw over that silly girl and find yourself a woman?
What are you getting at?
Oh, would you like to talk it over?
Is this some kind of joke?
Oh, I certainly hope not.
Well, maybe. I mean, sure. Okay, how about...
Tonight... Where you dropped off the Valentine? Last night?
Yeah. Okay, sure. See you later. Oh, by the way, how did you know where to reach me?
Oh, a friend told me.
Who? What friend?
The one right beside you. Until tonight.
Right beside me, but there's nobody beside me except... Except... The corpse.
Step on in.
You bet.
What's the matter? You staying cool with Coolidge, or just trying to think up something nice to say?
You sure look great.
What other way is there? Something tells me we're going to get along swell. Like some champagne?
Champagne? Sure thing. I really like your dress.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like a flapper. Out of the 20s. And the music. Nostalgia's really the thing these days, isn't it?
Mm.
Bottoms up. Here's to better behavior.
Champagne. What are we celebrating?
A happy prohibition. And a short one.
Prohibition. By the way, where is everybody?
All the little butterflies flew too close to the flame.
What? What's that?
The banks are on holidays, darling. Forever. And all their daddies have told them to come home and work for a living.
No banks? Oh, the crash.
Yes.
And you're dressed to crash yourself.
Almost had you there.
Hey, before I forget, how did you know where I was this afternoon? And what's your name, anyway?
Leave a lady a little mystery, will you? You'll find out soon enough.
Find out what?
Oh, don't be so serious, sport. Come on, the lady wants to dance.
I don't dance very well.
The Charleston's easy. Watch.
The Charleston? Are you kidding?
Nope. Like this. Don't be shy.
Okay. How's this, huh? How am I doing?
Well, you're doing great, Fred. Just great. 20 things to do.
Yeah. Kalamazoo or bust. This is fun.
It's the berries. Especially with the bubbly. More?
I don't know. Oh, why not? Thanks. It's kind of strange here, you know? I mean, where is everybody? I mean, really.
What's the matter, sport? Lonely?
No,
Why so distant? Hello?
Hi. I don't know. I mean, I don't know you or anything.
Well, what do you want to know?
Anything. Where do you come from? Your hopes? Your dreams? Anything.
Hopes and dreams? These days?
Yeah.
Watch out, I might tell you the truth.
I'm not afraid. What do you want?
Most of all, I want to distract handsome young men until they don't know whether they're coming or going.
Oh, well, nobody ever...
Ever what?
Never mind.
Maybe we should get a little more...
Private?
Of course, silly man. Wait here. I'll go in and get ready.
Hey,
easy. Easy, I'll only be a minute. And then you'll get to see me as I really am. I mean, that's what you want, isn't it?
Are you ready?
I'm turning out the light. You can come in now.
Oh. Here we are. You know, it's kind of funny. You just sort of know. You know what I mean? When you meet someone special, you kind of feel, well, right from the start.
Right from the start.
What's... Same old one, I tell you.
Yeah.
The same corpse right in my arms. Christ, I can still smell the formaldehyde.
How did they get you?
What's so funny?
Hey, I told you those sorority girls had a sense of humor, didn't I? We stole a body. They stole a body. Everybody's in the bodies.
Well, no one was in the house.
Oh, sure thing, Tiger, sure.
It was like she came back to life, but younger, as a flapper.
Mm.
I guess that's when she was our age.
Oh, wise up, Fred. Believe me, those airheads were in the next room laughing their guts out.
Yeah, I guess so. But I didn't hear them.
Anyway, thanks for the news, Tiger. About time to turn in for the night, huh?
Yeah. Maybe if I could get some sleep.
Well, I sure can. Oh, night.
Night.
Oh, hold it.
What?
Just make sure you're alone.
Snow's gonna stop tonight. So you wanna change your mind? It's gonna be Fantasy City up there.
No, I better stay here. Get some studying done.
Oh, come on. It'll be the last good skiing weekend of the winter. Slopes and strokes for all. And you don't even have to ski.
Thanks anyway.
Well, better be going. There's Janie. See you in a couple of days.
Yeah. See you later. Peace and quiet. Thank God. Oh. Hello?
Hello, sport. Or should I call you Tiger? You left in quite a hurry last night.
Who is it?
Oh.
It wasn't really that surprising, was it? Why don't we get together?
Look, I don't know who you are, and I'm sorry,
you
but
I... You know who I am, Fred.
This has gone far enough.
Don't be afraid, Fred. We belong together. You know we do.
No! My God. My God. I'll take the phone off the hook. That's what. I'll just take it off the hook. I know who you are. Almost 2 o'clock. Feels like 2 days. Why can't I get some sleep?
I couldn't wait any longer.
It can't be. It can't be.
It is. And you know, it's better when you wait.
Go away. Please.
I can't. You took me from my bed. You can't send me back now. When you wake the dead, we come to stay. Or at least, I do.
I didn't know. I didn't know.
How can we know in the beginning?
How can we? How can we?
Don't be shy. I promise I'll be good for you. No more loneliness. No more fear.
No loneliness. No fear.
The door, Fred. The door?
I'm coming. I'm coming.
Hi.
You're not wearing any clothes. Aren't you cold?
Of course not. I've never felt so warm. Come on, Fred. Time to go.
Where?
To my bed.
grave's a fine and private place.
But some, I think, do there embrace.
Short today, Dart. 2 weeks to midterm exam, and your partner doesn't think it's worthwhile attending anatomy lab.
Well, Fred's never missed one before, sir. I'm sure there's a good reason.
Yeah, I hope so, for his sake. All right, let's get going then. Get out the cadaver.
Right, sir.
What's going on there?
Oh my God.
Fred.
Out! Everybody out! Class dismissed! The police! Somebody call the police! Close the freezer!
Sir?
I said close that door! Well, what are you waiting for?
They look so happy, sir.
Have just heard Love and the Lonely One by John Graham. Featured in the cast were Elva Mae Hoover as the girl, Jay Bowen as Fred, and John Stocker as George, with Mignon Elkins as the hospital doctor and Graham Haley as the anatomy professor.
This segment we're going to turn to the Lieberbeck's Project, this time for volunteer Betsy Bush's reading of Evelyn E. Smith's The Blue Tower. The Tower was originally published in Galaxy Magazine's February 1958 issue, and is about the Belphins who came to the stars to look after us. As you can imagine, not everybody was pleased by that.
The Blue Tower by Evelyn E. Smith. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Betsy Bush, in Marquette, Michigan, November 2007. The Blue Tower by Evelyn E. Smith. As the vastly advanced guardians of mankind, the Belphins knew how to make a lesson stick. But whom? Ludovic Eversole sat in the golden sunshine outside his house, writing a poem as he watched the street flow gently past him. There were very few people on it, for he lived in a slow part of town, and those who went in for travel generally preferred streets where the pace was quicker. Moreover, on a sultry spring afternoon like this one, there would be few people wandering abroad. Most would be lying on sun-kissed white beaches, or in sun-drenched parks, or, for those who did not fancy being either kissed or drenched by the sun, basking in the comfort of their own air-conditioned villas. Some would, like Ludovic, be writing poems, others composing symphonies, still others painting pictures. Those who were without creative talent or the inclination to indulge it would be relaxing their well-kept golden bodies in whatever surroundings they had chosen to spend this particular one of the perfect days that stretched in an unbroken line before every member of the human race, from the cradle to the crematorium. Only the Belphins were much in evidence. Only the Belphins had duties to perform. Only the Belphins worked. Ludovic stretched his own well-kept golden body and rejoiced in the knowing that he was a man and not a Belphin. Immediately afterward, he was sorry for the heartless thought. Didn't the Belphins work only to serve humanity? How ungrateful, then, it was to gloat over them! Besides, he comforted himself, probably, if the truth was known, the Belphins liked to work. He hailed a passing Belphin for assurance on this point. Courteous, like all members of his species, the creature leaped from the street and listened attentively to the young man's question. "We Belphins have but one like and one dislike," he replied. "We like what is right, and we dislike what is wrong."
"But how do you tell what is right and what is wrong?" Ludovic persisted.
"We know," the Belphin said, gazing reverently across the city to the blue spire of the tower where the Belphin of Belphins dwelt, in constant communication with every member of his race at all times, or so they said. "That is why we were placed in charge of humanity. Some day you, too, may advance to the point where you know, and we shall return whence we came."
"But who placed you in charge?" Ludovic asked. "And whence did you come?" Fearing he might seem motivated by vulgar curiosity, he explained, "I am doing research for an epic poem." A lifetime spent under their gentle guardianship had made Ludovic able to interpret the expression that filtered across this Belphin's frontispiece as a sad, sweet smile. "We come from beyond the stars," he said. Ludovic already knew that. He had hoped for something a little more specific.
"We were placed in power by those who had the right, and the power through which we rule is the power of love. Be happy."
And with that conventional farewell, which also served as a greeting, he stepped onto the sidewalk and was borne off. Ludovic looked after him pensively for a moment, then shrugged. Why should the Belphins surrender their secrets to gratify the idle curiosity of a poet? Ludovic packed his portable scriptwriter in its case and went to call on the girl next door, whom he loved with a deep and intermittently requited passion. As he passed between the tall columns leading into the Flockhart courtyard, he noted with regret that there were quite a number of Coruscant's relatives present, lying about sunning themselves and sipping beverages which probably touched the legal limit of intoxicatability. Much as he hated to think harshly of anyone, he did not like Coruscant Flockhart's relatives. He had never known anybody who had as many relatives as she did, and sometimes he suspected they were not all related to her. Then he would dismiss the thought as unworthy of him, or any right-thinking human being. He loved Coruscant for herself alone and not for her family. Whether they were actually her family or not was none of his business. "Be happy," he greeted the assemblage cordially, sitting down beside Coruscant on the tessellated pavement. "Bah," said old Osmond Flockhart, Coruscant's grandfather. Ludovic was sure that, underneath his crustiness, the gnarled patriarch hid a heart of gold. Although he had been mining assiduously, the young man had not been able to strike that vein. However, he did not give up hope. For not giving up hope was one of the principles that his wise old Belphin teacher had inculcated in him. Other principles were to lead the good life and keep healthy.
"Now, Grandfather," Coruscant said, "no matter what your politics, that does not excuse impoliteness."
Ludovic wished she would not allude so blatantly to politics, because he had a lurking notion that Coruscant's family was, in fact, a band of conspirators, such as still dotted the green and pleasant planet, and proved by their existence that man was not advancing anywhere within measurable distance of that totality of knowledge implied by the Belphin. You could tell malcontents, even if they did not voice their dissatisfactions, by their faces. The vast majority of the human race, living good and happy lives, had smooth and pleasant faces. Malcontents' faces were lined and sometimes, in extreme cases, furrowed. Everyone could easily tell who they were by looking at them, and most people avoided them. It was not that griping was illegal, for the Belphins permitted free speech and reasonable conspiracy. It was that such behavior was considered ungenteel. Ludovic would never have dreamed of associating with this set of neighbors, once he had discovered their tendencies, had he not lost his heart to the purple-eyed Coruscant at their first meeting. "Politeness, bah!" old Osmond said. "To see a healthy young man simply accepting the status quo." "If the status quo is a good status quo," Ludovic said uneasily, for he did not like to discuss such subjects, "why should I not accept it? We have everything we could possibly want. What do we lack?"
"Our freedom," Osmond retorted.
"But we are free," Ludovic said, perplexed.
We can say what we like, do what we like, so long as it is consonant with the public good.
Ah, but who determines what is consonant with the public good?
Ludovic could no longer temporize with truth, even for Coruscant's sake.
Look here, old man, I have read books. I know about the old days before the Belthins came from the stars. Men were destroying themselves quickly through wars, or slowly through want. There is none of that any more.
All lies and exaggeration, old Osmond said. My grandfather told me that when the Belphins took over Earth, they rewrote all the textbooks to suit their own purposes. Now nothing but Belphin propaganda is taught in the schools.
But surely some of what they teach about the past must be true, Ludovic insisted. And today every one of us has enough to eat and drink, a place to live, beautiful garments to wear, and all the time in the world to utilize as he chooses, in all sorts of pleasant activities. What is missing?
They've taken away our frontiers.
Behind his back, Coruscant made a little filial face at Ludovic. Ludovic tried to make the old man see reason. But I'm happy, and everybody is happy, except a few killjoys like you.
They certainly did a good job of brainwashing you, boy, Osmond sighed, and of most of the young ones, he added mournfully. With each succeeding generation, more of our heritage is lost.
He patted the girl's hand.
You're a good girl, Corey. You don't hold with this being cared for like some damn pet poodle.
Never mind Osmond, Eversole. One of Coruscant's alleged uncles grinned. He talks a lot, but of course he doesn't mean a quarter of what he says. Come have some wine.
He handed a glass to Ludovic. Ludovic sipped and coughed. It tasted as if it were well above the legal alcohol limit, but he didn't like to say anything. They were taking an awful risk, though, doing a thing like that. And if they got caught, they might receive a public scolding, which was, of course, no more than they deserved. But he could not bear to think of Coruscant exposed to such an ordeal.
"It's only reasonable," the uncle went on, "that older people should have a thing about being governed by foreigners."
Ludovic smiled and set his nearly full glass down on a plinth. You could hardly call the Belphins foreigners. They've been on Earth longer than even the oldest of us.
You seem to be pretty chummy with 'em,
the uncle said, looking narrow-eyed at Ludovic.
No more so than any other loyal citizen, Ludovic replied.
The uncle sat up and wrapped his arms around his thick bare legs. He was a powerful, hairy brute of a creature who had not taken advantage of the numerous cosmetic techniques offered by the benevolent Belphins.
"Don't you think it's funny they can breathe our air so easily?"
"Why shouldn't they?" Ludovic bit into an apple that Coruscant handed him from one of the dishes of fruit and other delicacies strewn about the courtyard. "It's excellent air," he continued through a full mouth, "especially now that it's all purified. I understand that in the old days—"
"Yes," the uncle said. "But don't you think it's a coincidence they breathe exactly the same kind of air we do, considering they claim to come from another solar system?"
"No coincidence at all," said Ludovic shortly, no longer able to pretend he didn't know what the other was getting at. He had heard the ugly rumor before. Of course, sacrilege was not illegal, but it was in bad taste.
Only one combination of elements spawns intelligent life. They say, the uncle continued, impervious to Ludovic's unconcealed dislike for the subject, that there's really only one Belphin who lives in the Blue Tower, in a tank or something, because he can't breathe our atmosphere, and that the others are a sort of robot he sends out to do his work for him.
Nonsense! Ludovic was goaded to irritation at last. How could a robot have that delicate play of expression, that subtle economy of movement? Coruscant and the uncle exchanged glances.
But they are absolutely blank, the uncle began hesitantly. Perhaps with your rich poetic imagination.
See, old Osmond remarked with satisfaction. The kid's brainwashed. I told you so.
Even if the Belphin is a single entity, Ludovic went on, that doesn't necessarily make him less benevolent.
He was again interrupted by the grandfather.
"I won't listen to any more of this twaddle. Benevolent, bah! He, or she, or it, or them, is, or are, just plain exploiting us, taking our mineral resources away. I've seen 'em loading ore on the spaceships, and
exchanging it for other resources from the stars," Ludovic said tightly, "without which we would be, technologically, back in the Dark Ages from which they rescued us."
"It's not the stuff they bring in from outside that runs this technology," the uncle said. "It's some power they've got that we can't seem to figure out, though Lord knows we've tried," he added musingly.
"Of course they have their own source of power," Ludovic informed them, smiling to himself, for his old Belfin teacher had taken great care to instill a sense of humor into him. "A Belfin was explaining that to me only today." 20 heads swiveled toward him. He felt uncomfortable, for he was a modest young man, and did not like to be the cynosure of all eyes.
"Tell us, dear boy," the uncle said, grabbing Ludovic's glass from the plinth and filling it. "What exactly did he say?"
"He said the Belfins rule through the power of love." The glass crashed to the tesserae as the uncle uttered a very unworthy word.
"And I suppose it was love that killed Mike Salah and George when they tried to storm the Blue Tower," old Osmond began, then halted at the looks he was getting from everybody.
Ludovic could no longer pretend his neighbors were a group of eccentrics, whom he himself was eccentric enough to regard as charming.
"So," he stood up and wrapped his mantle about him, "I knew you were against the government, and, of course, you have a legal right to disagree with its policies. But I didn't think you were actual,
he drudged a word up out of his school days,
"anarchists."
He turned to the girl, who was looking thoughtful as she stroked the glittering jewel that always hung at her neck.
"Coruscant, how can you stay with these," he found another word, "these subversives?"
She smiled sadly.
"Don't forget, they're my family, Ludovic, and I owe them dutiful respect, no matter how pig-headed they are." She pressed his hand. "But don't give up hope."
That rang a bell inside his brain. "I won't," he vowed, giving her hand a return squeeze. "I promise I won't." Outside the Flockhart villa, he paused, struggling with his inner self. It was an unworthy thing to inform upon one's neighbors. On the other hand, could he stand idly by and let those neighbors attempt to destroy the social order? Deciding that the greater good was the more important, and that, moreover, it was the only way of taking Coruscant away from all this, he went in search of a Belfin. That is, he waited until one glided past and called to him to leave the walk.
"I wish to report a conspiracy at number 7 Mimosa Lane," he said. "The girl is innocent, but the others are in it to the hilt."
The Belfin appeared to think for a minute, then he gave off a smile.
"Oh, them!" he said. "We know. They are harmless."
"Harmless?" Ludovic repeated. "Why, I understand they've already tried to attack the Blue Tower by force."
"Quite, and failed. For we are protected from hostile forces, as you were told earlier, by the power of love."
Ludovic knew, of course, that the Belfin used the word love metaphorically, that the tower was protected by a series of highly efficient barriers of force to repel attackers, barriers which, he realized now from the sad fate of Mixshallah and George, were potentially lethal. However, he did not blame the Belfin for being so cagey about his race's source of power, not with people like the Flockharts running about subverting and what not.
"You certainly do have a wonderful intercommunication system," he murmured.
"Everything about us is wonderful," the Belfin said noncommittally. "That's why we're so good to you people. Be happy."
And he was off. But Ludovic could not be happy. He wasn't precisely sad yet, but he was thoughtful. Of course, the Belfins knew better than he did, but still, perhaps they underestimated the seriousness of the Flockhart conspiracy. On the other hand, perhaps it was he who was taking the Flockharts too seriously. Maybe he should investigate further before doing anything rash. Later that night, he slipped over to the Flockhart villa
and nosed about in the courtyard until he found the window behind which the family was conspiring. He peered through a chink in the curtains so he could both see and hear. Corisande was saying,
"And so I think there is a lot in what Ludovic said."
Bless her, he thought emotionally. Even in the midst of her plotting, she had time to spare a kind word for him. And then it hit him. She, too, was a plotter.
"You suggest that we try to turn the power of love against the Belphins?" the uncle asked ironically.
Corisande gave a rippling laugh as she twirled her glittering pendant.
"In a matter of speaking," she said, "I have an idea for a secret weapon which might do the trick."
At that moment Ludovic stumbled over a jug which some careless relative had apparently left lying about the courtyard. It crashed to the tesserae, spattering Ludovic's legs and sandals with a liquid which later proved to be extremely red wine.
"There's someone outside," the uncle declared, half rising.
"Nonsense," Corisande said, putting her hand on his shoulder. "I didn't hear anything."
The uncle looked dubious, and Ludovic thought it prudent to withdraw at this point. Besides, he had heard enough. Corisande, his Corisande, was an integral part of the conspiracy. He lay down to sleep that night beset by doubts. If he told the Belphins about the conspiracy, he would be betraying Corisande. As a matter of fact, he now remembered, he had already told them about the conspiracy, and they hadn't believed him. But supposing he could convince them, how could he give Corisande up to them? True, it was the right thing to do, but for the first time in his life, he could not bring himself to do what he knew to be right. He was weak, weak, and weakness was sinful. His old Belphin teacher had taught him that, too. As Ludovic writhed restlessly upon his bed, he became aware that someone had come into his chamber.
"Ludovic," a soft, beloved voice whispered, "I have come to ask your help."
It was so dark he could not see her. He knew where she was only by the glitter of the jewel on her neck chain as it arced through the blackness.
"Corisande," he breathed.
"Ludovic," she sighed. Now that the amenities were over, she resumed,
"Against my will, I have been involved in the family plot. My uncle has invented a secret weapon which he believes will counteract the power of the barriers."
"But I thought you devised it."
"So it was you in the courtyard. Well, what happened was I wanted to gain time, so I said I had a secret weapon of my own invention, which I had not perfected, but which would cost considerably less than my uncle's model. We have to watch the budget, you know, because we can hardly expect the Belphins to supply the components for this job. Anyhow, I thought that, while my folks were waiting for me to finish it, you would have a chance to warn the Belphins."
"Corisande," he murmured, "you are as noble and clever as you are beautiful."
Then he caught the full import of her remarks.
"Me? But they won't pay any attention to me."
"How do you know?"
When he remained silent, she said,
"I suppose you've already tried to warn them about us."
I said you had nothing to do with the plot."
"That was good of you," she continued in a warmer tone. "How many Belphins did you warn then?"
"Just one. When you tell one something, you tell them all. You know that. Everyone knows that."
"That's just theory," she said. "It's never been proven. All we do know is that they have some sort of central clearinghouse of information, presumably the Belphin of Belphins. But we don't know that they are incapable of thinking or acting individually. We don't really know much about them at all. They're very secretive."
"Aloof," he corrected her, "as befits a ruling race, but always affable."
"You must warn as many Belphins as you can."
"And if none listens to me?"
Then she said dramatically,
"You must approach the Belphin of Belphins himself."
"But no human being has ever come near him," he said plaintively. "You know that all those who have tried perished, and that can't be a rumor, because your grandfather said—"
"But they came to attack the Belphin. You're coming to warn him. That makes a big difference. Ludovic."
She took his hands in hers,
In the darkness, the jewel swung madly on her presumably heaving bosom.
"This is bigger than both of us. It's for Earth."
He knew it was his patriotic duty to do as she said. Still, he had enjoyed life so much.
"Coruscant, wouldn't it be much simpler if we just destroyed your uncle's secret weapon?"
"He'd only make another. Don't you see, Ludovic? This is our only chance to save the Belphins, to save humanity. But, of course, I don't have the right to send you. I'll go myself."
"No, Coruscant," he sighed. "I can't let you go. I'll do it."
Next morning, he set out to warn Belphins. He knew it wasn't much use, but it was all he could do. The first half-dozen responded in much the same way the Belphin he had warned the previous day had done, by courteously acknowledging his solicitude and assuring him there was no need for alarm. They knew all about the Flockharts, and everything would be all right. After that, they started to get increasingly huffy, which would, he thought, substantiate the theory that they were all part of one vast coordinate network of identity, especially since each Belphin behaved as if Ludovic had been repeatedly annoying him. Finally, they refused to get off the walks when he hailed them, which was unheard of, for no Belphin had ever before failed to respond to an Earthman's call, and when he started running along the walks after them, they ran much faster than he could. At last he gave up and wandered about the city for hours, speaking to neither human nor Belphin, wondering what to do. That is, he knew what he had to do. He was wondering how to do it. He would never be able to reach the Belphin of Belphins. No human being had ever done it. Mixhalaw and George had died trying to reach him, or it, even though their intentions had been hostile, and Ludovic's would be helpful. There was little chance he would be allowed to reach the Belphin with all the other Belphins against him. What guarantee was there that the Belphin would not be against him, too? And yet he knew that he would have to risk his life. There was no help for it. He had never wanted to be a hero, and here he had heroism thrust upon him. He knew he could not succeed. Equally well, he knew he could not turn back, for his Belphin teacher had instructed him in the meaning of duty. It was twilight when he approached the Blue Tower. Commending himself to the infinite virtue, he entered. The Belphin at the reception desk did not give off the customary smiling expression. In fact, he seemed to radiate a curiously apprehensive aura.
"Go back, young man," he said. "You're not wanted here."
"I must see the Belphin of Belphins. I must warn him against the Flockharts."
"He has been warned," the receptionist told him. "Go home and be happy."
"I don't trust you or your brothers. I must see the Belphin himself."
Suddenly, this particular Belphin lost his commanding manners. He began to wilt, insofar as so rigidly constructed a creature could go limp.
"Please, we've done so much for you. Do this for us."
"The Belphin of Belphins did things for us," Ludovic countered. "You are all only his followers. How do I know you are really following him? How do I know you haven't turned against him?"
Without giving the creature a chance to answer, he strode forward. The Belphin attempted to bar his way. Ludovic knew one Belphin was a myriad times as strong as a human, so it was out of utter futility that he struck. The Belphin collapsed completely, flying apart in a welter of fragile springs and gears. The fact was of some deeper significance, Ludovic knew, but he was too numbed by his incredible success to be able to think clearly. All he knew was that the Belphin would be able to explain things to him. Bells began to clash and clang. That meant the force barriers had gone up. He could see the shimmering insubstance of the first one before him. Squaring his shoulders, he charged it and walked right through. He looked himself up and down. He was alive and entire. Then the whole thing was a fraud. The barriers were not lethal, or perhaps even actual. But what of Mixhalaw and George, and countless rumored others? He would not let himself even try to think of them. He would not let himself even try to think of anything save his duty. A staircase spiraled up ahead of him. A Belphin was at its foot.
Behind him, a barrier iridesced.
"Please, young man," the Belfin began, "you don't understand. Let me explain."
But Ludovic destroyed the thing before it could say anything further, and he passed right through the barrier. He had to get to the top and warn the Belfin of Belfins, whoever or whatever he or it was, that the Flockharts had a secret weapon which might be able to annihilate it or him. Belfin after Belfin Ludovic destroyed, and barrier after barrier he penetrated until he reached the top. At the head of the stairs was a vast golden door.
"Go no further, Ludovic Eversol," a mighty voice roared from within. "To open that door is to bring disaster upon your race."
But all Ludovic knew was that he had to get to the Belfin within and warn him. He battered down the door. That is, he would have battered down the door if it had not turned out to be unlocked. A stream of noxious vapor rushed out of the opening, causing him to black out. When he came to, most of the vapor had dissipated. The Belfin of Belfins was already dying of asphyxiation, since it was, in fact, a single alien entity who breathed another combination of elements. The room at the head of the stairs had been its tank.
"You fool," it gasped, "through your muddle-headed integrity, you have destroyed not only me, but Earth's future. I tried to make this planet a better place for humanity, and this is my reward."
"But I don't understand," Ludovic wept. "Why did you let me do it? Why were Mikshalaw and George and all the others killed? Why was it that I could pass the barriers and they could not?"
"The barriers were triggered to respond to hostility. You meant well, so our defenses could not work."
Ludovic had to bend low to hear the creature's last words.
"There is Earth proverb. Should have warned me. I protect myself against my enemies, but who will protect me from my friends?"
The Belfin of Belfins died in Ludovic's arms. He was the last of his race, so far as Earth was concerned, for no more came. If, as they had said themselves, some outside power had sent them to take care of the human race, then that power had given up the race as a bad job. If they were merely exploiting Earth, as the malcontents had kept suggesting, apparently it had proven too dangerous or too costly a venture. Shortly after the Belfin's demise, the Flockharts arrived en masse.
"We won't need your secret weapon now," Ludovic told them dully. "The Belfin of Belfins is dead."
Coruscant gave one of the rippling laughs he was to grow to hate so much.
"Darling, you were my secret weapon all along."
She beamed at her relatives, and it was then he noticed the faint lines of her forehead.
"I told you I could use the power of love to destroy the Belfins." And then she added gently, "I think there is no doubt who is head of this family now."
The uncle gave a strained laugh.
"You're going to have a great little first lady there, boy," he said to Ludovic.
"First lady?" Ludovic repeated, still absorbed in his grief.
"Yes, I imagine the people will want to make you our first president by popular acclaim."
Ludovic looked at him through a haze of tears.
"But I killed the Belfin. I didn't mean to, but they must hate me."
"Nonsense, my boy. They'll adore you. You'll be a hero."
Events proved him right. Even those people who had lived in apparent content under the Belfins, accepting what they were given and seemingly enjoying their carefree lives, now declared themselves to have been suffering in silent resentment all along. They hurled flowers and adultery speeches at Ludovic, and composed extremely flattering songs about him. Shortly after he was universally acclaimed president, he married Coruscant. He couldn't escape.
"Why doesn't she become president herself?" he wailed, when the relatives came and found him hiding in the ruins of the Blue Tower.
The people had torn the tower down as soon as they were sure the Belphin was dead, and the others thereby rendered inoperant. It would spare her a lot of bother. "Because she is not the Belphin Slayer," the uncle said, dragging him outside. "Besides, she loves you. Come on, Ludovic, be a man." So they hauled him off to the wedding, and amid much feasting he was married to Coruscant. He never drew another happy breath. In the first place, now that the Belphin was dead, all the machinery that had been operated by him stopped, and no one knew how to fix it. The sidewalks stopped moving, the air conditioners stopped conditioning, the food synthesizers stopped synthesizing, and so on. And, of course, everybody blamed it all on Ludovic. Even that year's run of bad weather. There were famines, riots, plagues, and after the waves of mob hostility had coalesced into national groupings, wars. It was like the old days again, precisely as described in the textbooks. In the second place, Ludovic never forgot that when Coruscant had sent him to the Blue Tower, she could not have been sure that her secret weapon would work. Love might not have conquered all. In fact, it was the more likely hypothesis that it wouldn't, and he would have been killed by the first barrier. And no husband likes to think that his wife thinks he's expendable. It makes him feel she doesn't really love him. So, in 30th year of his reign as dictator of Earth, Ludovic poisoned Coruscant, that is, had her poisoned, for, by now, he had a minister of assassination to handle such little matters, and married a very pretty, very young, very affectionate blonde. He wasn't particularly happy with her either, but at least it was a change.
And this brings us to episode 4, which is an episode of Mystery in the Air. Mystery in the Air was a summer replacement show for the Abbott and Costello show between 1945 and 1947. Unfortunately, only 8 episodes are known to exist, and those are from the 1947 series. You know, we all tend to think of Harry Morgan as a TV actor, but like most early TV actors, Morgan had deep roots in radio. Here, on this show, he's the announcer and plays the occasional character. In all, these shows were well made, with an excellent, sophisticated soundtrack, recorded live for each show. This particular episode, The Marvelous Barrasto, is from a script by Ben Heck, which was also produced by Suspense in 1944, starring Mr. Orson Welles. If you'd like to hear the Suspense version with Orson Welles, you can drop by the website, www.nighttransmissions.com. Go to show number 14, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and you'll find a link.
Mystery in the Air, starring Peter Lorre, presented by Camel Cigarettes.
Yes?
You're Mr. Amos G. Hall, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Who are you?
I'm Barrasto, the hypnotist and magician. They call me the Marvelous Barrasto.
What do you want? How did you get in my office?
I said I was a magician. I do such things.
Well, why have you come to see me?
Why? Because you're a great lawyer, and I'll have need of your services soon.
Indeed?
Yes, indeed. Because tonight I shall commit a murder.
Each week at this hour, Peter Lorre brings us the excitement of the great stories of the strange and unusual, of dark and compelling masterpieces culled from the four corners of world literature. Tonight, The Marvelous Barrasto by Ben Hecht.
Mystery in the Air, starring Peter Lorre, brought to you by Camel Cigarettes.
Oh!
famous criminal lawyer Amos G. Hall sits staring into the hypnotic eyes of the marvelous Barrastro, who has just announced that tonight he will commit murder.
Yes, Mr. Hall, for a long time, I've dreamed only one dream, to kill this man.
Why? Who is he?
Rico Sansoni. Have you heard of him?
No, can't say that I have.
Well, he's a great magician, a great hypnotist, yes. He's clever, he's too clever. I've hunted him from country to country, from city to city, all over the world. Sometimes I've almost caught him. In London, I only missed him by only 2 hours, but tonight I shall meet him face to face.
You know where he is then? Right now?
Yes. Rico Sansone is here, in this city, now. Tonight he opens in his first stage performance, and I'll be there, waiting for him.
Well, apart from the legalistic aspects of the case, why do you want to murder this man?
Why? Listen closely, Mr. Hall, and perhaps you'll know a part of my hate for this fiend. Oh, it began some time ago. I was traveling with a small carnival through Eastern Europe. I cast horoscopes, I read the future, I revealed the past, and conversed with the spirits. That is how I earned a meager living. Well, one night our carnival came to a village, somewhere in Mellow Russia. Peasants and the villagers gathered around our tents and wagons, and through a hole in a black box where I stood, I watched a crowd while a barker made his spiel.
Barrastro, the magician who speaks with the dead, tells the future, reads the secrets of life. Barrastro, who reveals
and then,
the past.
Then I saw her. She had a young and gentle face. She was beautiful. Oh, so beautiful, I couldn't take my eyes away. And then to my indescribable joy, a peasant led her in, and I saw at once the girl was blind.
This is my granddaughter, Anna. She would like you to tell her fortune.
Can you tell my future?
Yes, Anna, I can.
Will it be a happy one, my future?
Well, show me your hand, and I'll tell you.
Here.
I took her hand. And suddenly, I felt a chill. I could hear the voices which foretell the future.
Fly, fly, run, run.
Yes, I could hear them, and fear, a great fear gripped me, but the girl's beautiful, sightless eyes, they were so full of hope and faith, I just couldn't tell her the truth. Spirits promise you great happiness, Anna.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, your hands will touch beautiful things, and love and great happiness await you.
Oh, thank you, sir. Oh, thank you, thank you.
That was the beginning. Her face never left me that night, and I couldn't sleep. The next morning I looked for her, and I found her. We walked through the hills, and she spoke of the trees she could not see.
I call that tree lullaby, because it sings when it sways in the wind.
Yes.
And this other I call prayer. They told me its branches open toward heaven.
I was with her that whole day, and the next, and the next, and we walked often in the hills and the forest, and she knew every turn in a path. We were in love, and when it came time for the carnival to move on, I asked Anna to come with me as my wife.
You make me very happy, Gregor. I could live only with you. I love you with all my heart.
And I love you with all my heart, Anna. And I'll care for you and I'll protect you.
And you'll teach me, Gregor. You'll teach me to see.
To see?
One doesn't need eyes to see as you do.
No, one does not.
Oh, please, Gregor, teach me to see beyond the horizon. Please teach me to see as you see.
Yes, Anna. My sweet little Anna. And the day we were married, we rode together in a gilded wagon, and the vows were taken under a clear sky. But immediately after, the sky suddenly changed. I realized what I had done. It was I. It was I who was carrying out the terrible message of the stars. For it was I that fate had selected to destroy her. From that moment on, I was haunted. One evening, it was less than a month later, I stood in a black box outside my tent, and I knew it had come. That graceful, smiling man who stood before the tent, he was studying Anna. Not once did he take his eyes from her. Hey, you! You, why do you stare at her?
Let go of my eye.
I don't want you to stare at her.
Who are you?
That makes no difference. She's my wife.
Oh, I most humbly beg your pardon, sir. You see, I was admiring your wife.
Yes?
Allow me to introduce myself. I'm Rico Sansone, the hypnotist and magician. I'm going on a world tour soon, and I'd hoped she could join me as my assistant. I feel she has remarkable psychic powers.
She is blind.
I apologize doubly for my seeming forwardness.
Oh, I knew he sensed the ominous shadows around her as I did, but then he smiled, and I was disarmed, and soon I became interested in his talk. He talked like a friend. He flattered me about my knowledge of the secrets of our profession.
I noticed you performed a disappearing cage trick, Verastro.
Yes, I do.
A most difficult one that you performed magnificently.
Thank you. Well, come, Sansone, I'd like you to meet my wife. She's here in the wagon.
Delighted, my dear Verastro. It's a privilege I'll not forget, let me assure you.
Oh, Gregor.
Hello, Anna.
Gregor, who is that with you?
Oh, it's a gentleman I want you to meet. Anna, this is Rico Sansone.
A great pleasure and a great sorrow. You see, I've been watching you tonight in the hope I could persuade you to become my assistant. But now I learn you're this charming gentleman's wife. How fortunate is the marvelous Balastro.
Marvelous Balastro? Anna, did you hear what he called me? Anna, what's the matter? Have you no word of greeting for our guest?
No.
What's the matter, Anna?
I have nothing to say.
I'm sorry. You see, my wife and I, we seldom had a visitor.
I understand perfectly. But I hope that she will like me when she gets to know me better.
And so, Rico Sansone entered our lives. In the days which followed, he attached himself ever more closely to us, as a lonely man would who seeks the friendship of those he likes. But Anna, she would never trust him. Sometimes after he would leave at night, she'd whisper,
I don't like him, Gregor. I don't like...
Why?
I feel something strange from him.
And I, like a fool, I would always defend him. I'd remind her of his gay talk and how he made us laugh and how interested he was in me and my methods of magic. Oh, I was flattered that even Rico wanted to learn from me. One night, Anna and I had just finished our dinner. She turned to me. She had a troubled expression on her beautiful face.
Gregor, there's something I must tell you.
What, my sweet? Are you getting tired of this kind of life, huh?
Oh, no, Gregor. It's this afternoon.
What about this afternoon? What about it, Anna?
Rico.
What about Rico?
This afternoon, Rico came here and talked to me as he always does.
Yes.
I suspected nothing. Then he took my hand in his and asked me if I loved you.
He asked you what?
If I loved you even more than happiness or life.
What did you say?
I was so frightened. I just asked him to leave. I don't like him, Gregor. I'm afraid.
Again, I reassured Anna. After all, what had happened? Nothing. Well, our friendship continued. Weeks passed. The carnival had moved to Hamburg, and we had taken an apartment in the city. We spent the days together, and he was more and more interested in my every word and thought and mood, and as always, I was flattered by him.
You have a funny way of saying beautiful, my friend.
Hmm?
How is it again?
Beautiful.
Yes. Yes, that's it. Beautiful.
Look, Rico, you were telling me about that.
Beautiful. Oh, I like you, Gregor. I like you very much.
Yes, amazing, isn't it? How one can be taken in by flattery. Yet so clever was he, I never realized the terrible truth of his friendship with me. I was in my tent one afternoon when a warning swept over me. It was all of a sudden, but I couldn't mistake it. I left the tent and I hurried to the apartment, and carefully I opened the door. Yes, there was Rico, standing with his arms around my wife, her face raised to his lips. She kissed him. And then I heard him talk. It was my voice he was using. My voice, completely mine. At the sound of his voice, a nameless fury seized me. Now I knew why he'd been so interested in me, why he'd spent so many hours with me. He'd learned to perfection how to use my voice. Now his words seemed to come from my own throat. I sprang forward, shouting, Rico, Anna, don't touch him! Don't get him!
Amos G. Hall, the attorney, sits at his desk fascinated by the magician Barastro as he tells his strange story. Now the attorney leans forward.
That is incredible.
Yes.
You mean this Sansoni had studied your speech and mannerisms so perfectly that he was able to deceive your wife?
Yes, incredible as it may seem.
Well, go on.
Fine. I hardly remember rushing across the room. All I could think of was to kill this man, to kill him. Anna screamed, and he and I, we struggled across the room over chairs and tables, against the walls and the window. I saw him through my rage. Every feature had changed. He was Barastro. There were two of us. Yes, two. Barastro screaming, together fighting. Then he had me by the throat. His strength was terrifying. The breath began to leave my body as this horrible fiend changed and became Rico Sansoni again.
Barastro, have mercy, man. Gregor, you're killing me. I am dying.
Yes, he was pretending it was I who was killing him. He would kill me and live with Anna as Barastro. His cruel eyes burned into mine, and he leaned close to my ear and whispered,
"You fool, I'll kill you for her."
It was then that I cried with all my might, "Anna! Anna!" And then suddenly a great darkness
flooded over me.
I don't know how much time had gone by when I opened my eyes. I looked around the room. It was gone. Then I saw Anna. She was crouched against the wall. I tried to whisper. Anna. Anna. I began to drag myself across the floor to her. When I got to her side, I tried to reach her hand. She pulled it away and screamed. And then I realized her terror. Who was in the room with her? Was it Rico? Was it her husband? How could she know? I pleaded with her. I assured her again and again that Rico had gone, but she remained against the wall, her hand held in her teeth and staring into the terrible dark around her. Frantically, I searched my mind for words to tell her it was really I. Look, Anna, listen. Remember, Anna? Remember our walk through the hills? First time? See, remember, Anna, your trees? Remember them? The one you called lullaby? And the one whose branches pointed to high? You called it prayer. See? See, Anna? It is. Listen carefully. Look, remember I read your future? It's the first time we met. I said, the spirits promise you happiness and your hands will touch beautiful things. Love and great outweigh. And you said, oh, thank you, sir, thank you.
Gregor. Gregor, help me.
Yeah.
Gregor, please help me. Go, don't
hurt me. Yes, Anna. Yes. Rico had disappeared, but from that day on, I had only one thought, to guard against the day I knew must come. She traveled all over Europe, and she learned to smile and be happy again, and at times I felt her fears had left her.
Vienna's such a lovely city, Gregor. I knew it'd be like this in the spring. Gregor, these mountains, they're like the ones near my village.
Mm-hmm.
Why, I can almost see them. Oh, it's wonderful to be home, Gregor.
Yes, yes.
To walk in our hills and over the old paths again.
Well, at last I felt it was safe to get a job in a cabaret. I had to get a job. Our savings were almost gone, and I had only worked there 2 weeks when I felt that same terrible warning sweep over me again. Choked and dizzy, I ran to our cottage. Yes, yes, Rico was back. I stood there, most silent. Listen.
My Gregor.
I heard her laugh like a child. All I knew, I had to kill this devil who would take my wife, my identity, my happiness. I am sure if I had been able to think, I would have realized that I shouldn't rush into the room because it would kill her. I'm sure Rico knew it, but all I could think was I had to kill him. And then, Mr. Hall, I had a terrifying idea. What if Rico killed me? He'd go on living with her as Barastro, and she'd never know. See, Mr. Hall? Well, I opened the door and walked in. Anna, don't touch him. It's Rico. Anna! This, sir, is my memory of Anna. She tore at her eyes with her hands, as if to tear away the darkness. As I rushed to her, she fell. She didn't speak again, and the next morning she died. Huh? Sansoni. I think you understand now, Miss Hall, why I'll kill Rico Sansoni tonight. Now you know why I may need your services to defend me. No, not my life, but my name and my honor. Good night, Mr. Hall.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've practiced criminal law for 25 years, and I've heard many strange tales. But that night, I couldn't sleep. The next morning, there was an item in the paper. A train had hit a car in which two magicians were riding. One was killed, his body so badly cut up as to be unidentifiable. The other was in the hospital. I hurried over there, made inquiries, and went to the room. I quickly told the nurse my business, and she led me to the bed. Two burning eyes, all that was left of a face, stared out through a mass of bandages as the nurse leaned over close to him.
Your attorney, Mr. Hall, is here.
Yes.
Well, I guess you'll not have any need of my services after all. The police haven't placed a charge against you, have they?
Police? Why should they? It was an accident. Just a bad accident.
Well, it must have been perfectly done. You know, the only thing I don't understand, how could you have killed him in the accident and not be killed yourself?
Well, I'm the marvelous Barrasto, am I not? Why don't you believe me?
It's not particularly common for night transmissions to have more than four segments, but this week we have five. The fifth and final segment is from The Strange Dr. Weird. It's an episode called The Man Who Lived Twice, and it's from January the 20th of 1945.
The Strange Dr. Weird.
Good evening. Come in, won't you? You seem a bit nervous. Perhaps it would help if I told you a story about a friend of mine who had a most unusual experience. You see, he was executed first and then committed murder afterwards. I call his story The Man Who Lived Twice. My story, The Man Who Lived Twice, begins on the gallows, where Professor Karl Muller, world-famous scientist, is about to die for murder. As the executioner finishes adjusting the rope around the condemned man's neck, the warden speaks.
Well, Muller, is there anything you wish to say?
Only this. You are hanging me for a crime I did not commit. Very well. Then I shall become a criminal, a murderer. And you, warden, you shall be one of the first to feel my vengeance.
Proceed with the execution.
Professor Williams.
Yes, come quickly.
Of course, everything's ready and waiting, right here.
Good. Start the artificial heart pumping.
Of course.
Thanks to the governor's special order, everything went smoothly. Look, John.
So you got it.
Yes. The law has Professor Muller's dead body, but we have his head. The head containing the wonderful brain of Karl Muller. The governor thought I wanted to dissect it, but we'll bring it to life. We must work fast. In 10 minutes, we'll have brought back to life the genius that was Karl Muller.
We've won, Professor. Look! His eyes, they blinked.
Yes.
Now they're opening.
They're staring at us. His brain lives and knows what we're doing. Now, John, we must find some way to let that mighty brain we've rescued from the grave speak to us. So so that its great work may be carried on. Come, John, we must work fast.
For many days, Professor Williams and John tried to build some kind of vocal apparatus which would enable Karl Muller's still living head to speak to them. But each effort failed, until at last they became desperate.
Another failure. John, I'm afraid we're beaten.
There must be some way, Professor. Look, Muller's eyes are watching us. He knows what's happening. I'll bet he could tell us what to do if he could talk.
Yes, but he can't. What was that?
Something in the road outside. An automobile accident, perhaps.
Oh, of course. John, we may not be able to keep Muller's head alive much longer. Unless we can communicate with him. I need his advice.
There must be some answer.
Muller's notes give full details. Someone's at the door. Quick, lock it. No one must enter this room.
Help me.
It's someone who's hurt. He's bleeding. That crash we heard.
Please help me. Accident. Car hit the tree. It's thrown out and flooded.
Hey, catch him, quick.
I've got him. He's fainted.
Put him down on the couch here. Let me look at him.
What is it?
This fellow's dead. A bit of steel has apparently entered the temple here and pierced the brain. I'm surprised that he even lived to reach the door.
Dead? Well, then I better phone the police to send the morgue wagon.
Yes, I... No. Wait.
Yes, Professor?
John, look at this stranger whose dead body fate has brought us. His head is the same size and shape as Karl Muller's. Professor Muller's brain should fit into this stranger's head almost exactly.
Yes, but...
Listen. Here we have a sound body with a damaged brain. Over there is Muller's brain alive, but with no body. John, we're going to do it. We're going to put Muller's brain into this stranger's body and truly bring Muller to life again.
Say, Doctor, tonight's story has me a little worried. Do you think you could give us a little idea of what happens next?
Certainly. You're going to spend no more than 40 seconds talking about Adam Hat.
Oh, I can do it in 30. Gentlemen, the way an Adam Hat keeps its smart appearance is something to marvel at. There's very little fussing with brims or constant blocking, because an Adam is made of high-quality, long-wearing, all-fur felt. Adam Hats are designed for fashion, too, coming in a wide variety of distinctive shades and shapes, so that you can choose the Adam that's right for you. There's a flair to an Adam that just naturally does something for a fellow. Prices are only $3.45 to $10 at Adam Hat stores and authorized dealers everywhere. Tomorrow, make an investment in your personal appearance. Buy yourself an Adam Hat. Now, back to Dr. Weird.
And now to continue my story, the man who lived twice. For an hour, Professor Williams and John worked swiftly to carry out the task of transferring the living brain of Karl Muller into the body of the stranger, so providentially brought to them by fate. At the end of that time...
Look, John, he's breathing.
The operation was successful.
Yes, I can feel a pulse beat. Switch off the pumps. See? He lives! He lives!
The body, yes. But the brain... Will that live too?
Only time will tell us.
For weeks, the two scientists tended their amazing patient day and night. And then one day, the stranger's body moved, a sign that the transplanted brain had taken control of its new home. But after that, it was only a matter of days before Karl Muller was able to get up and dress and inspect in a mirror the new body that had become his.
Yes. Yes, Professor Williams, you have done well. Excellently. I find it hard to believe this is truly me, Karl Muller.
But it is. And how the world will marvel when it learns the truth.
The world, yes. Tell me, this body that is now mine... To whom did it belong before our little transfer?
You were named Larry Johnson, Professor. That's about all we know. You see, there was an accident and...
Yes, I know. I witnessed the arrival of Mr. Johnson, remember. But you know nothing of this Larry Johnson who staggered in so fortunately that day to present me with his body?
No, we never made any inquiries. We didn't want to attract attention.
You are wise. It does not matter who I was. What does matter is that I am now Karl Muller, A genius with 50 years of life still ahead of him. But, of course, I cannot use the name of Muller.
What do you mean?
Karl Muller was convicted for the crime of murder because the subject died in an experiment. So Karl Muller must stay dead. But as Lady Johnson, a new scientific genius, will arise to astound the world.
What that means?
It means that no one must ever know what happened in this laboratory.
No one ever know.
It must be a secret. Yes. And for another reason, too. Those fools who convicted me, they must be made to pay, and they shall with their lives.
What are you saying?
I was convicted of murder. I shall become a murderer. The judge, the prosecutor, the jury, they shall all feel my vengeance.
That's madness, Muller. Listen to me. Your brain has been affected by what happened.
My brain is clear and stronger than ever. I shall have my vengeance secretly, cleverly. My victims, they will cower in terror the thought I am striking back at them from beyond the grave. I have been making my plans as I convalesced.
No, we'll stop you.
Will you? I think not.
John, look out. He's got a scalpel in his hand. He's got... Oh. You killed him.
Yes. Now it is your turn.
No, no, stay away from
you
me.
You must die so my secret will remain safe.
You're mad.
I'm a genius. The world, it will cower at my feet before I am through. But enough of talking.
No. Let me go. Let me...
All who stand in my way shall suffer the same fate. Now no one in the world knows that Karl Muller, who died on the gallows, lives again.
A few hours later, Karl Muller left the house. His plan was simple. He would take over Larry Johnson's identity, claiming that the accident he had been in had given him amnesia, and he could remember nothing of his past. Confidently, he walked into town, and then stopped at the first policeman he met, the way to the address he had found in Larry's wallet.
Pardon me, officer. Which way is Michigan Avenue, please?
Why, Larry. Larry Johnson.
Why, yes, of course I'm Larry Johnson. What of it?
What of it? I'll show you what of it. There, put up your hands or I'll plug you. Oh,
just a moment. What is this? I have done nothing.
You have done nothing.
Look, officer, I've been in an accident. My memory...
You'll be in a worse accident if you try anything. I've got you now.
But I don't understand. What...
You'll understand when the judge sentences you to hang, you murdering rat.
Hang? No, this can't be.
You'll find out.
No, I've done nothing.
Let go of that gun.
No.
Let go. I'll plug you.
Give me that gun.
I'll shoot it.
I'll
shoot it. I warned you. Well, you had it coming. I've only saved the state the price of a trial.
Yes. Yes, you have. What was Larry Johnson wanted for, anyway?
What were you wanted for? For holding up a bank messenger and then killing Officer Clancy in your getaway, that's all. Yeah, and for stealing a getaway car which you wrecked and abandoned out in the suburbs.
No. Wanted for murder. The body I took was... wanted for murder. No.
Poor Professor Muller. To think that after being executed, he should get a brand new body, only to find himself wanted for murder all over again. It looks as if fate was determined he should stay dead, doesn't it? And he has, since then. In fact, he's buried in the cemetery outside. He's the only man in the world who has two graves and is buried in both of them. Would you like me to show them to you? Oh, you're leaving. I hope you'll drop in again soon. Just look for the house on the other side of the cemetery. The house of Dr. Weir.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of another show. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll come back next week. Until then, this is Gary Clinton, and this is Billy May playing Ira Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Good night.